Accession number 4586, reel number 1.
Air Commodore Sutcliffe, Reel 1. When did you first join the Air Force, Air Commodore Sutcliffe?
Well, I went to RAF College Cranwell in 1930, straight from school. So it was January 1930, and it was really then only 12 years after the end of World War One, which of comparable time today would mean 1957, 12 years after World War Two. And I went there to learn to fly airplanes and become a general duties officer. It was at Cranwell where those destined for permanent commissions in the Royal Air Force went for training. Permanent commissions were also awarded to people who'd been through university courses, where, of course, they had university air squadrons to help them on their way and learn to fly. Cranwell, however, was a sort of main training place for the permanent commissioned general duties officers. By general duties, I mean pilots. I think Lord Trenchard, in the early days of the Air Force in 1918-1919, because the airplanes were very simple to fly, he visualized these pilots having time on their hands when they weren't flying. And there's also the problem of commanding men, and they had to be given other jobs but than piloting. So he made them into the general duties branch, and as such, they're expected to double for accountants, engineers, equipment officers who are away on holiday, leave, or sick. And this worked out pretty well because even the duties of those people were very relatively unsophisticated compared to what they are today. So I joined Cranwell and I stayed there for 2 years, during the course of which we were kept hard at it all day long. I think we were allowed leave periodically 3 times a year, about a fortnight at a time. Otherwise, one weekend pass in 4 was allowed, and then we had to stay in camp all the time. Our time was taken up starting about 8 o'clock in the morning with colour hoisting parade, which we all had to turn up to, followed by lectures and or flying, alternating, and then that carried on throughout the afternoon. After tea, we had a games period, and then we always had to parade for dinner in the evening. By this means, we were kept on the hop all day long, right up to going to bed, as it were, which was good for us, because it kept us out of trouble, one thing or another. And it's very enjoyable.
Before we go on with more details about Cranwell, could I ask you why it was that you decided to go in for the RAF?
Well, I was attracted to the services, and don't forget, it was only 12 years after the end of the First World War, and there were the British Armed Forces had large commitments all over the world then with the Empire. For example, Iraq, there was a command in Iraq, a command in Aden, a command in India, command in the Far East and the Mediterranean. So there are plenty of places and opportunities overseas to go and visit. The life was not unattractive, and there was plenty of excitement and plenty to do. Air power was then in its relative infancy, and there was no BOAC or large airlines, and the RAF were helping to develop air routes all over the world. For example, they opened up the route from Cairo to the Cape. They flew to Singapore in flying boats, all of which was gaining experience in the positioning of air bases en route to places like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and so on around the world. So I thought to myself, here's an opportunity and for a lifetime service, which was very attractive and which I wanted to do.
But you could have got overseas service in the Army or the Navy as well.
That is very true, but I was attracted to aviation because, whereas on the ground in the Navy and the Army, you were constantly obeying other people's orders. But in the Air Force, once you got airborne, there was relatively very bad communication with the ground. And if you didn't like what they're saying on the ground, you just pull the socket out and you're on your own.
Did this ever happen?
Oh, often, yes. Because if the radio reception and transmission in those days was very poor indeed, and you just got fed up with all the crackling and noises, not being able to understand what's being said. So the natural thing was to pull the plug out, because you couldn't hear what they were saying anyway. If they gave you an order, you couldn't obey it. But that was, again, it's an independent action, independent, being independent was a great attractiveness too.
What type of reputation did the RAF have in those days as a very new service as compared with the reputation of the Army and the Navy?
I'm afraid it wasn't very good. We were the youngest service, and in many ways we had the youngest people in the service than the other two. They regarded us rather harum scarum types, good time Charlies and that sort of thing. We were frowned upon by insurance companies, for a start, together with actors and Jews, I don't know why, for motor car insurance. I suppose because we and they were always having accidents of some sort through furious driving. But the Air Force, being a very junior service, was looked down upon by the other two, and this happened in public all over the place, at dinner parties, people's houses, and so forth.
How much did you know about the career prospects in the Air Force before you joined?
Well, I'd follow that up, because we had to take the civil service exam before we entered, and I think that was more or less covered in that curriculum, the civil service exam. And the I knew, for example, how the Air Force started under Lord Trenchard in 1918, and developed a combination of the RNS and RFC. And because you had ex-RN officers and ex-Army officers in the service, you had a good cross-section of experience between the three services. But when we came along, we had no experience of the Army, no experience of the Navy. So we're a new breed of Air Force men, as it were.
When you first went into the Air Force in the early 30s, what was the reputation of the men from the First World War days, the flies of the First World War days, amongst the new entrants?
Oh, we admired them tremendously and had great respect for them. Again, they were people who liked individual action. For the simple reason that nobody on the ground could tell them what to do because of lack of communication to the ground. They could tell them, brief them for what job they wanted done by them in the air. And then it was entirely up to the pilot concerned how he carried out that job. And nobody on the ground could tell him how to do it, except briefing-wise beforehand. But he couldn't. Once he got airborne, it's entirely up to him.
Was there any element of feeling amongst people of your generation that the flies from the First World War days were people who'd had their day and were old-fashioned or an obstruction to progress in any sense?
No, none of that whatsoever. I think the reason for that was that we still had the biplanes, still flying biplanes, the same type of planes were flying during a war, World War One, only, of course, better engines, better equipment. But basically, they were the same aeroplanes. And as I said before, we had the greatest respect for these chaps, who, of course, had war medals up and we hadn't, DSOs and DFCs. And you did really respect them. And we had no quarrel with them whatsoever for being old-fashioned or whatever like that.
Coming back to your Cranwell days now, what was the social background of the people who were going into Cranwell at the same time as yourself?
Cranwell drew its entrance from, I think, three sources. First were the public schools, the second, public schools and grammar schools together, and then they had Halton and a signal school at Cranwell, where they had sort of scholarships for their best candidates, and they could gain entry into Cranwell that way. So there were four sources, really. I did say before, we had to pass this civil service exam, which was quite a stiff one. And I think in my entrance, there were 700 candidates for Cranwell, and they only wanted 30, you see. So you had to do pretty well in the exam to get it. So academics came into it in a big way. So I can't think of any other... There was no other means of getting into Cranwell in those days. And, of course, the biggest thing was the physical exam. You had to go to the medical people, and they put you through a very stiff test indeed. If there's anything wrong with you at all, they failed you, and you didn't get in.
Would you say that the entrants who went in at the same time as you came from a narrow or a broad social range?
Well, it certainly wasn't a very broad one, I don't think, except... it's a difficult question to answer that, because we did go quite a few from the ranks, as it were, through Halton, where they trained airmen, and Flowerdown, and Cranwell Electric and Wire School itself. No, I may be wrong there. I think it's fairly broad. Fairly broad. Mm. Of course, the numbers from the public schools and grammar schools were greatly in excess of the others.
And what about the pressure of work at Cranwell? Was it intense or was it fairly free and easy?
It was fairly intense. They gave you plenty to do. For example, as I said before, we were allowed one weekend a month, and that meant we had to be kept busy on Saturdays and Sundays. We used to attend lectures on Saturday mornings after the initial colour hoisting parade, up to about midday. The afternoon was then set aside for whatever you wanted to do. It was a free afternoon. You could play games, you could go out, go to the local town, whatever. But you had to be in by midnight. And many of us scrambled, we had to make it by the deadline. If we didn't, we got what was called jankers. We put on, I think universities call them being gated. You had to stay in. We weren't allowed out on Saturday afternoons for a period. Then, of course, it was Sunday. Well, the men, as well as the officers and the cadets, we were called flight cadets, incidentally, all attended church parade, the whole shebang. We all paraded, marched off to church, and outside the church, Roman Catholics and Jews had to fall out because they didn't want to go to the C of E service. They couldn't be forced to do so. So the big cry went up, fall out, Roman Catholics and Jews.
Were there many of those?
Not very many, about three or four, I think. But they used to fall out and stand behind, then go off and read the Sunday papers in the mess. But then we had Sunday afternoons free. But by and large, we were kept at it all the time for 2 years.
What did the lectures consist of?
History, Air Force history, airmanship, theory of flight, physics, in the sense of wherever it applied to aeronautics, engineering. We had engineering workshops, and we had to go and practice all the things which the airmen, fitters and riggers had to do. So when we eventually got into the service, we knew something about engines and airframes and how they were constructed and so forth.
Did you feel that the years at Cranwell were a good preparation for your later Air Force career, or do you think there were some gaps which might have been filled?
Well, once we left, you see, I think we had an edge over what we then call the short service officers or pilots, who joined for perhaps 5 years and then went to the reserve. They went through similar establishment to Cranwell, and they're called flying training schools, and I think there were about five or six of them in the country. And they all trained the short service officers, who of course had to be trained in larger quantities than permanent commission ones, because their tour of service lasted for 5 years before they transferred to the reserve, and then another lot had to be trained to take their place and keep the numbers up. But I think we got better training than they did, because we spent longer at Cranwell than they did at their flying training schools.
Was there any special way in which this showed itself later? Or was it just a general thing?
It's just a general thing, I think. There was no sort of jealousy between the two sets. And we got on very well together, made firm friends, both. Which showed up later when they were called up when World War II started.
What about leaving Cranwell? Did you have a series of exams to get through?
Yes, we had the usual sort of tests, and we were graded in the exams, and we had a flying test as well. We had to pass all these tests before we were fully commissioned. Then there was a big sort of ceremony at which all the prizes would be presented to those who fortunate enough to win them.
What type of prizes were these?
Well, I remember one as humanistic prize, which a friend of mine won. It was a flying prize, the Groves Flying Prize, which I happened to win, and a Sword of Honor. And the chief prizes were the three or four, which included the ones I've just mentioned.
What was the failure rate?
Very small. The failure rate was occasioned mainly, and I think almost 100%, through inability to cope with flying, slow reactions, or not medical, but slow reactions and just inability to go solo, really. Much of the decision there rested with the flying instructors who taught us, and the chief flying instructor. The foreman was grounded from flying. He'd be tested by the chief flying instructor, whose word would be law. He'd make the decision.
These boys who found that they were just unsuitable for flying officer material, were they lost to the RAF altogether, or were they given other jobs?
Well, they could. A friend of mine went into the equipment side of the RAF, which was on the ground, Another went to Sandhurst with the army, where, having passed the exam, they all passed the academic examination, the civil service one, you see, so they're still qualified to enter the others, provided their age is right. So those are the only two I can think of who actually failed in my day and were accommodated, one in the army and the other in the equipment branch, the Air Force.
What happened to you personally after you left Cranwell?
Well, I left in December 1931, and after Christmas leave, posted to 207 Squadron Bertram Newton in Norfolk. This was a squadron composed of Fairey 3Fs. There were two squadrons on the station, number 35 and 207. Both had the same type of airplane, and the station was commanded by a group captain C.W.H. Pulford, his name was. It's a happy station, we all got on well together, but some wag once said the only difference between Bertram Newton and overseas was that overseas you do what they call colonial allowance, you got a bit more pay for being an awkward spot.
Was this because it was so isolated?
It's very isolated, yes. And some of the characters who liked the gay life found it a bit trying. But others who liked the country life enjoyed it thoroughly.
The particular planes you were flying, these ferries, how did you find them to fly?
They were all right, but they weren't very exciting. They were two-seaters, powered by an Apeline engine, fixed undercarriage biplanes. And you couldn't aerobat them. You couldn't. Just sort of straight flying all the time, which wasn't very exciting. On the other hand, there were bomber planes. There were day bombers. And our job was to become proficient in bombing and gunnery, which caused us once a year to go off to a practice camp where we operated from with just the bare basic facilities. This is a good training in case the squadron got moved overseas. You think. These two squadrons were on the short list for overseas in case emergencies overseas. We had to be ready to pack up and go immediately. For this purpose, we used to have a sort of reserve store of equipment, which was in packs. And all that got to be done is to lift those packs onto a truck and off you'd go. You got all your spares for a fortnight or 3 weeks, and that sort of thing. But the old Fairey 3F wasn't. I preferred other airplanes to that. It wasn't a very exciting one.
Were there any particular problems with flying it?
No, it's straightforward. Of course, we didn't have any proper blind flying instruments in those days. You had to turn a bank indicator, and that's about all, and an airspeed and an altimeter.
Could you describe the cockpit of the 3F, what equipment you'd have in front of you?
Well, it's pretty basic. You'd have an airspeed indicator, an altimeter, sometimes a turn and bank indicator, which was just coming in when I joined. Otherwise, we had a sort of bubble arrangement, which showed when the airplane was sort of straight and level. Throttle, stick and rudder bar, and your seat. The windscreen, that's about it. So it's pretty basic, same as it was in World War I, you see, without any of these sophisticated things they got these days.
So if you had fog, for example, would you be automatically grounded?
We wouldn't normally fly, we wouldn't fly in fog. If fog was threatened, it would be on the ground in those days. Unless we were going from A to B. If A was in fog, we might take off if the fog wasn't too thick and land at B, which is not in fog. But if fog is extensive, we wouldn't be flying.
Did you do any night flying with the...
Yes, we used to keep in practice on night flying. We didn't do so much night flying as we did day flying. As I said before, we're a day bomber squadron, and there were special night flying bomber squadrons with Vickers Virginias. Elsewhere, and their prime function was the night bombing force. However, we were trained to fly by night because on certain occasions, although we started out in daylight, we might have to come back by night, you see, to land by night. So that is the basic reason for that.
What were the lighting arrangements for landing at night?
Paraffin flares, which had to be lit by hand, filled by hand. But they used to have a thing. You didn't have any big flying control towers like you have now. All you had was a hut in the middle of the airfield with a character called a duty pilot living there, not living there, but there. And it's his job to keep an eye on things and alert the crash tenders and ambulances if there's an accident or a crash, and generally see to visitors who've arrived and let the other end know the visitor arrived safely. But this job used to come around about once a month. You had to put on your British and putties, which we had to wear in those days, our best blue and number one blue, and go out and stay in this duty pilot's hut whilst flying was on. Quite a responsible job, really. You had to see to all requirements of visitors, have to alert the crash tenders and ambulances if there's an accident. But there was no sort of control as you've got it today. The pilots who took off were advised to look around, make sure the way was clear before they took off. Nothing was coming into land, and so forth. So that the duty pilot didn't have anything to do in that way. At night time, he stood on the flare path and all this lamp, a green and a red, and used to flash those, green, okay to take off, or land, and a red, don't take off or don't land.
Did any accidents occur at Bertram and Newton whilst you were there?
Yes, one, and not very many, I must say, but a friend of mine had some problem with the fog one day and didn't make it. He flew into the ground. Fortunately, he wasn't hurt because the speed at which these airplanes flew wasn't that great. He probably struck the ground about 80 knots. But he survived and he's very well today.
What was the consequence of an accident?
Straight away the big court of inquiry convened to find out what went wrong, who was to blame, if any. And if they found someone to blame, well, appropriate action was taken against the individual. As a pilot, he was might be admonished, reprimanded, or lose seniority. If he's an airman on the maintenance side, he might be disciplined, reduced in rank, or he wouldn't be fined, though. We didn't have fines in those days. They have fines today, I believe.
You mentioned the bombing practice. Mm. Where was that carried out?
Well, we used to have a local bombing range just off the airfield, probably a bit of waste ground or field which the Air Ministry had bought. There'd be a target in their circle with a blob in the middle, and that would be our target for local bombing. Otherwise, there were ranges up and down the country. There's one at Sutton Bridge in the Wash. There's another one at Orford Ness, way down south in Essex. And I believe there were two inland. I forget where they were now, but we'd do odd trips to those. And once a year, the squadron would go off to practice camp to... I remember going to Sutton Bridge. The only one I went to was just on the Wash, where they'd live in sort of rough conditions, wooden huts and the like, and operate there for about a month, carrying out their annual bombing tests, and then return to base, having completed those tests.
How accurate could you be in those days with the equipment that you had for bombing?
Not bad, I think. There are... you get errors about 50, 60 yards. But, you had no anti-aircraft against you. It was all absolutely steady as a rock as you were on the run in. And much depended upon the operator of your bomb sight, as well as the pilot. There's a combination between the two to achieve a good the small bombing errors.
How could you and the bomb airmen communicate with each other in the air?
We used to have a thing called a Gosport tube system, which is purely a mouthpiece with a tube going down wherever the bomb aimer was, and he had sort of earphones, and he plugged into the other end of the pipe, plugged his earphones in the other end of the pipe, and that was it.
Could he speak to you?
You had a similar, another tube going back to the pilot, so he had two tubes coming down, so he could speak to each other.
Could you hear each other all right?
Oh yes, quite all right. No problem.